dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight on the program, in our first hour, a look at touchscreen computer voting machines and election rigging. And in our second hour, the Wizards of Money returns with a look at low-income borrowers and mortgage misconduct.
I never took food from the widows and orphans.
Free and fair elections are the basis for America's claim to democracy. Our electoral process is manipulated in a variety of ways that result in a government that arguably fails to reflect the needs of most of us. Reformers who seek to redress this state of affairs hang their hopes on somehow being able to wrest elections back from the corporate money stream. Now, even the slender hope of changing the country's direction through the ballot box could be extinguished by the machine that records your vote. Or, more to the point, doesn't record your vote. During the tense months of wrangling that followed the 2000 election, the corporate press steered clear of the allegations that election fraud was committed by the Bush campaign and focused instead on the mechanics of voting equipment, hanging chads and pregnant chads. Congress, taking a cue from the press, instead of focusing on the misconduct of officials from the lowest level to the people on the top court, decided to forever vanquish the hanging chad by drafting a piece of legislation called the Help America Vote Act, HAVA, that would fund the installation of high-tech new touchscreen voting machines across the nation. These machines are touted as cost-effective and labor-saving, as well as being a boon to blind people or those who would prefer a ballot in a language other than English. But computer scientists are raising the alarm that these voting machines' most salient feature is the ease with which elections could be rigged and the difficulty of detecting tampering either before or after the fact. Under HAVA, states were charged with implementing a plan of voting reform. The state of New York has drafted a 48-point plan that would include the expenditure of $140 million to buy these touchscreen voting machines. Public comment on the plan must be received by Wednesday, July 23rd. To bring this to the attention of the community, the Progressive Coalition of the Finger Lakes brought computer scientist Dr. Barbara Simons from California's Silicon Valley to Montour Falls to speak last Saturday. Dr. Simons earned her Ph.D. at the University of California, Berkeley in 1981. Since, she has served as an expert advisor on a variety of government committees and panels, as well as being involved in research for IBM. Dr. Simon will be co-chairing a national workshop in Denver this month on voter verifiable election systems. We go now to Dr. Simons. I will give websites and phone numbers at the conclusion of her speech, which is about 53 minutes long. So New York State listeners hopefully have time to get something to write with if they would like to make a public comment to the New York Board of Elections.
So first let's talk about computer-based voting machines. There are really two kinds we're talking about. One is optical scan, which is not going to be the main topic for today. But I wanted to mention it because optical scan machines are cheaper than these touchscreen machines, which is what we will be talking about. And they have many advantages. You don't have to worry about what we call voter-verified paper ballot, and I'll explain more. I mean, I'll go into detail about what we mean by that. In other words, you don't have to trust the machine. If it's done locally, you can actually put your ballot through the reader, the ballot reader, and it can give you feedback as to if you've had any over or under votes. I mean, one of the arguments for touchscreen machines is that they won't let you vote twice for president, which they won't, assuming they're programmed correctly. But you can also get that advantage from optical scan ballots. So I just want to emphasize that there are alternatives to these touchscreen machines, which are being used in a number of places. In San Mateo County, for example, in California, they use them and they're working just fine. A disadvantage that people will talk about with these is the issue of multilingual ballots and problems for people with disabilities. I think the multilingual ballot issue is, it's not clear to me that that's a real issue. You can print out optical scans in different languages. Obviously, you have problems with verifying that the translation in one language is the same as the English version, but you have that problem anyway. I mean, that's just a problem that you've got. Yes? The translation problem is one that exists in general. It's not unique to optical scan ballots. And as far as people who are blind, for example, being able to use them, I'm not quite sure how one deals with that. That is an issue. One can provide touchscreen, some sort of other device with the touchscreen machines with the earphones for blind people. That's one approach. So anyway, that's about all I have to say about optical scan machines, unless someone has a comment. Okay, the rest of the talk is going to be about what we call DRE machines. DRE means direct recording electronic. So again, advantages. These are touchscreen machines. I'm sure you're all familiar with using touchscreens when you go to the ATM and so on. Again, they could be multilingual. They can be relatively easy to use for people with disabilities, depending on the disability, of course. But you can hook up a micro, earphones to a computer and have it read aloud to you what the ballot is saying. They can compute instant runoff or proportional representation relatively easily. So DRE disadvantages. It says most here have no voter verifiable audit trail. I say most because some machines are coming out now that do have these. But most of the machines that are being sold today do not have it. And in fact, what happens, because HAVA does require that there be ballots printed out, these ballots are printed out at the end of the election. And I say that for the, people who know about computers in this audience will immediately realize that printing out the ballots at the end of the election means what gets printed out is what's inside the computer, which may or may not be accurate, right? There is no national standard. Now, the HAVA Act said that NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, is it? Anyway, NIST, which is a national government agency, was supposed to develop standards. But there was no funding allocated. So there were no national standards. The software that runs these machines is all proprietary. You can't look at it, even if you think election may have been fixed or there had been bugs in the software. They can't, even though these machines are touted as being really easy, in fact, there are many cases where they've been difficult to operate and update. People have had trouble booting them up. Sometimes they've crashed. There have been problems with them, and they are expensive. In fact, Ruth was asking me last night, why did they cost $7,000 each? And I don't know. Because, I mean, this little machine, cost less than half of that when it was brand new and, the hottest thing on the market. So I don't know why they cost that much. Just don't know. Anyway, these machines already, DRE machines are already being used in almost 20% of the among 20% of U.S. voters. There are a small number of vendors nationally, very small. Probably count them on all your, you don't need all your fingers to count them. Maybe you do. Maybe you need all of them. As I say, the software is secret. The testing is done in-house or by independent testers, but it's not available for computer security experts to test. Sometimes the code is held in escrow in some places. But there have been instances, and I believe there's an example of it in one of the horror stories I have, where the code was held in escrow, but when the election was challenged, nobody was allowed to look at it. So then you have to ask, what's the advantage of holding in escrow? And I'm going to claim that the testing is inadequate. There have been many instances where serious errors were not detected before the machines were put in use on election day. So one example is the Diebold system, which is used throughout the entire state of Georgia, which has no paper ballots. Several of the system locked up after a few hours of use in spite of having been tested in a mock election. I mean, the fact of the matter is that software can be very complicated it needs to have very good testing, it needs to have very good standards. When you think about the pressures that the voting machine manufacturers are under, they got to get these things out by election day. I mean, you know, before election day, before a certain time before election day. So they have very hard deadlines they have to meet. As I said, there's a lack of specific strong national standards, and I'll get into more details later. So weak security measures. Security through obscurity is something which we computer scientists encounter a lot of among people who really don't know computer security. The idea is if you keep something a secret, it's going to be harder to break. This is a big deal in some of the encryption issues that we were encryption. For those of you who don't know what it is scrambling information to keep it secret. So it's basically when we had codes in World War II, so that the Japanese and the Germans couldn't read our codes, that was encryption. So encryption is a case where that was happening, it still is happening, where people think by keeping the encryption algorithm a secret, it makes it harder to break it, and that's just not true in general. When you're dealing with security issues, you have to assume that your adversary has access to the algorithm. It can still, if it's a good encryption algorithm, it can still be impossible to break, or we think it can be impossible. But you want a system that is so secure that even if your adversary has all this information, it can't be broken. So that's a bad way to keep secrets, but that seems to be one of the things that's being used by these software vendors. That's one of the reasons they say they have to keep their code secret. Because they keep their code secret, that gives it more security against being abused, which I know is an extremely weak argument. As I say, there's a lack of strong technical national standards for testing and for security both. And then there's the insider threat. You see the quote from the FBI, which says the disgruntled insider is a principal source of computer crimes. 55% of all respondents reported malicious activities by insiders. And in the case of the elections, insiders can be a programmer at the vendor or a third-party provider because they don't just develop their own software, they use a lot of software from other sources. It could be anyone with authorized or unauthorized access, or it can be an intruder into the system. And Microsoft very conveniently provided me with this next slide. Just a couple days ago, there was a big announcement, I don't know how many of you saw it, of a major vulnerability that was uncovered in Microsoft Windows Server 2003, which was just recently introduced. It's supposed to be their extremely reliable, extremely secure operating system. It's been touted for being that, and yet this vulnerability was discovered, which would allow a hacker to seize control of the machine and to steal information, delete files, and read email. It also impacts Windows 2000, NT, and XP, and I should point out that Windows 2000 and above are platforms that are intended to be used for internet voting that's going to take place in 2004. So these machines could already have been compromised. Current election software may have been compromised. So this is basically the issue we're talking about, what we call the DRE auditing gap, where you've got the touch screens where the voter goes and, you know, chooses his or her vote on the machine that go in, and then you've got something that comes out, right? It may or may not be what the voter intended. And the question is, how do we know, how can we guarantee that the election will be accurately counted, that the vote will be accurately represented? And you can't trust the computer to accurately represent the vote all the time. So you need a backup system, as it were, and that backup system is paper ballots. So as this slide says, paperless electronic voting requires that the software and hardware be perfect. And that's the thing that computer scientists, I mean, when I talk to computer scientists about having elections with no paper, they're just astounded. Because if there's anything we know the software ain't perfect and the hardware ain't perfect, but especially the software ain't perfect. And I don't know how many of you have heard about, you know, have you ever had your computers crash? I mean, ever? Do you believe they're perfect? And many of these are systems that have been around for a long time and worked on for a long time, whereas a lot of these election systems are new. And they're built on top of some of the software that you have that crashes. So the question is, why should we trust these machines? One of the interesting things, so I've been involved with this issue now, you know, in a serious way. I first got involved in 2001 when I was on a study committee that was looking at internet voting. It was sponsored by the National Science Foundation in response to a request from President Clinton to examine internet voting. And that's the first time I really thought about this issue. And it was an interesting experience because the commission consisted of three different groups. It was voting officials, computer scientists, and social scientists. And the social scientists and I think the voting officials came into that meeting feeling that internet voting would be fantastic. It would be a way of getting people to more involved with the electoral system, of getting people to vote more, and so on. The computer scientists came into that meeting thinking, we can't believe you're serious. And by the end of the meeting, I think we'd convinced pretty much everybody that, or maybe not everybody, but almost everybody, that this was a very risky undertaking, internet voting. So that was the first time I thought about it. But at the time, I didn't think so much about these DRE machines. They weren't being used at that time, and they weren't really an issue. So a few months ago, I started getting involved with this when David Dill, who's a professor at Stanford, started his petition where he's been soliciting signatures from computer scientists and now from the public at large on this. And he has almost 1,000 signatures of computer scientists, including most of the top computer security experts in the country on his petition. But what's interesting is the people who are pushing for these machines frequently attack those of us who are raising this issue as being Luddites. And I just find that amazing because they surely don't know the definition of Luddites. I mean, we're the techies. You know, it's the technical community who are really raising the issue. And that's because we know how insecure the stuff we do is. Yes?
Who are the people that are attacking this idea?
That's an interesting question. The League of Women Voters National has been very difficult to work with. I hate to say this, I'm a League member. I think that one or two people there have managed to convince the president that this is a great idea. She even thinks internet voting is a good idea. I saw a quote of hers in a news article saying touting internet voting. A lot of the local leagues are very upset. A lot of the league members are very upset. Certainly, I mean, I know quite a few of them who are. And we're not consulted. This policy came out of the blue. And I don't quite understand what's going on, quite frankly. I really don't understand. It's been extremely frustrating for me because I think the League should be the organization which is there to preserve our vote, and I don't understand it, except to say that I think the people who are making this decision don't understand the technology. They didn't consult us beforehand, and once you make a decision, especially a public one, it's very hard to go back. So if anyone has any suggestions on how to deal with that, I would really appreciate it. It's been extremely frustrating. There are other groups too. I could talk to you more about it afterwards. I think that one thing that's happening is that the vendors of these voting machines know the election officials quite well, and they're sort of buddies. And so there's this tendency to go with the people you know and to believe the people you know. And people who don't know computer security are being told, you don't have anything to worry about. These things have been really thoroughly tested. And they believe it because they don't understand the technology, and they, you know, and it makes their life a lot easier to believe it. So DRE horror story. So in the 2000 election in Middlesex County, New Jersey, the Sequoia DRE was taken out of service after 65 votes. No votes were recorded for the Democratic and Republican candidates for one office, even though their running mates received 27 votes. Sequoia claimed no votes were lost. And there's no way to know. In Wellington, Florida, March 2002, runoff election between two candidates only. The final tally, as you can see, was 1263 to 1259. 78 ballots had no recorded votes at all, even though there was only one office to vote for. And the claim is that 78 didn't vote for anybody. Don't know. Boca Raton, this is one of my favorites. The Boca Raton mayor's race in 2002. The former mayor, Emile Dansieux, came in third with there was an 8% undervote in the election. Undervote means people who didn't vote for mayor, which was a high figure. And it was also a bit suspect because there were low numbers reported in his home precinct where he was expected to do extremely well. Sequoia sold the system with trade secret protection, as these all are sold, and it was a third-degree felony in Florida to reveal the specs or the software. The circuit judge refused to allow inspection of the software when the election was challenged, but he granted Dancio a walk inspection of equipment. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I know Rebecca Mercury went with him on that. And what they discovered was that the pre-election testing tested only for the first position on the ballot, and his name was third. Furthermore, the voting machines were reprogrammable. And, you know, the way these machines are certified, they're certified presumably with particular software. They're programmable. That means they're not certified anymore, right? I mean, it should mean that, if they're reprogrammed in any case. And at the end of the election, the machines were placed in a mode where you couldn't test them. So no testing was possible. In Nebraska, Chuck Hagel, who was elected a senator in 96 and again reelected in 2000, in 96 was the president, and he had a large ownership in the company that sold the machines that were used to count in Nebraska. And by 2002, that company had been bought by another company, which then manufactured DRE machines, and he was a large stock owner in that company. He hadn't made this information available in his disclosure statements, his public disclosure statements. In Georgia, in 2002, the entire state election was held on deep old DRE machines with no paper ballot. As you probably know, there was a big upset. The incumbent Democratic Senator Max Cleland had been favored to win in pre-election polls and exit polls and lost. There's no way to know if the votes were accurately represented. I know that there are some people who are also concerned about the election for governor and some representatives, Barr and McKinley, McKinney, Barr being Republican and McKinney being Democrat. This, as Ruth said, this is really a bipartisan issue. If you're going to talk about fixing elections, you can fix them for Republicans or Democrats. You know, it goes both ways. This How to Steal an Election slides that came from David Jefferson, who has been working, he's a computer scientist, has been working in the election area a long time. So this is, for those of you who have never coded, this is sort of an imitation of what software looks like. It says, Trojan logic undetectable by testing. Trojan means it's stuck into the machine without your knowing it. You know, Trojan horse, you know, the whole notion of a Trojan horse. So it's in there, and you don't know it's there, and then it comes out at some point. Like, the idea is you add this code, and you hide it. So the code basically says, if this was not a test but a real election, then cheat, otherwise behave honestly. That's sort of a high-level description of the code. And now, how do you know this is a real election? It's a real election if the machine is not in test mode, and there are ways of determining that, and the date is the election day, and all votes came in via touch screen, and the vote count is in the right range. So in other words, and I'm sure you can put other conditions here. The idea is that you want to put enough conditions in here that almost any testing procedures that are used will be detected by the software. And by the way, if you're going to fix the election, if you're going to have software that fixes the election, it can make the fixes at the very, very end. So it can just sit there watching, trying to figure out if this is a test or the real thing. And if it determines it's the real thing, then it makes the fixes at the very end. So, you know, it can do it all, you know, a minute or two before the election's over. The way you normally do testing is you'll feed a bunch of inputs into the machine and see what the outputs are. But that's not the way people vote. So that the way that people do testing is not the way people vote. That's the whole idea. No votes have been changed or missed. I mean, when people vote, they make mistakes. But when you're testing, you have all the data right there. It just goes zoom into the machine. The votes come in through a file system or a serial port or some other way aside from the touchscreen and our audio driver. So, I mean, basically, if the votes are coming in from some way that they wouldn't be coming in if you were actually having an election. The idea is that in the old days, in the good old days with paper ballots, you still could fix elections. We know elections have been fixed from time immemorial. But, you know, like, even in Boston, when they would fix elections, they had to do it on a precinct-by-precinct basis. Here, you just get the code changed, and it's nationwide. So, now, for those of you who aren't happy with probability, I will explain this. So, basically, the probability of a half, in other words, the computer flips a coin, and there are ways to simulate a coin flip in a computer. So it flips a coin, and if it's heads, it does nothing. If it's tails, then it's going to randomly, random is key here. It's going to randomly change a small percentage of votes from one party to the other. Random. The reason that random is important is because even if somebody notices that there's something wrong and you try to run the test again, it'll give you different answers because it's random. It won't do the same thing the second time unless its random number generator is broken. And you won't be able to tell if it's a bug or if it's a fix because it will behave differently. Okay, what that top line says is ways to hide Trojan logic in DRE code. This slide is for the techies in the audience and the rest of you don't pay too much attention to it. Basically, this is just a list of ways that one can hide the logic because people say, well, it'll get found in testing or in code examination. There's a wide variety of ways of doing it. You can have misleading documentation. You can bury the logic deep in some very obscure part of the code. That's what several of those things say. You can modify commercial code that's been purchased, and we already know that those can be buggy. You can get into one of those and modify it, and it probably won't be tested by the testers because they're just going to be testing the election code, not the commercial code. You can modify compiler or linker, so this is just basically stuff that takes the software that's written for the code and crunches it so that it can run on the computer. And there are tricks you can do so that even if the software, even if the source code doesn't do anything bad, you can use a compiler. You can take your compiler, which translates it into machine language, and your compiler can do something bad. So you basically have to make sure that that compiler is not malicious, doesn't have malicious code in it. And it's impossible to do, basically. Okay, this slide says why the independent testing authorities will not catch this code tampering, aside from the fact that it's going to be hard to catch for anybody. There are additional issues. The independent testing authority has to check for likely sources of bugs, reliability compromise, and privacy violation. And there's really an issue of time here. As I say, remember, we've got deadlines when we're dealing with election code, election software. So the chances of stumbling across a test configuration that actually exhibits cheating are quite remote. And again, if you have randomization and you happen to stumble across one of these, it's not going to be repeatable. And then you have problems of distinguishing between operator error and bugs and fraud. And basically, we don't have the methodology for doing this. And then again, the claim is that election fraud is more difficult to find than other software frauds because the design documents and code are all secret. So only the independent testing authority can even look at them. So the solution to that is make it not secret. Make it public. I personally find it astounding that we're willing to hand over responsibility for our elections to companies which do it in secret. I mean, I just find it mind-boggling. Election code might be audited only once by the ITA, Independent Testing Authority, and if it passes, it may never be audited again. And we've seen that there are systems where you can reprogram the code. Sometimes a large portion of the code, namely the commercial code that's been purchased that it runs on, is never audited. And since the election code runs only once a year, there are no independent checks that it's operating correctly. So the question was, what would it take to open up the independent testing authority? Would it take federal legislation? It might, but I'm not sure that's the way to go, because if you have the voter authenticated paper ballots, you don't need it. So I hope I'll convince you of that later on. Yes, question. So the question is, would a class action suit about the theft of our civil rights be a possible way to go? Actually, I have an idea for another way to go, which is taking some of the wording from HAVA and claiming that it's not being enforced. So we'll get to that. Right, so the question is that you might be the person who's trying to undermine the election. You don't know beforehand who the people are going to be. Is that what you're saying? But you do know the parties. You can identify the parties. So basically what you have is you have code which runs the entire election. And the computer is the election device entirely. So it goes from taking your input to counting the votes. And at any point along that route, you could do something to subvert the election. Now, because the ballots are printed out at the end of the day, whatever gets printed out has to be what you report. But of course, you can print out something very different from what people voted. So anywhere along the chain, you can subvert it. I don't know if that quite answers your question. Maybe we should take this offline and talk about it. DRE software cannot follow normal industry development practices. So the idea is that this software is certified. And because it's certified, once it's certified, you don't want to change it. So what do you do if you find bugs? If you've got to go in and do a bug fix, technically, it should go through the entire certification process again. I don't think it does, but it should. So that's the thing about recertification. Whereas with most software, when people find bugs, they issue a new release, right? I mean, you all get new releases all, you know. Sometimes they charge you for it, even. But in the case of elections, especially if you're a large vendor and your machines are being used in many different states, you've got to be recertified in each of those states. So this is a real problem. Therefore, it can be either very slow and expensive to fix, and therefore, you might want to avoid doing it. That's what that last thing says. Or it'll be very lax. Okay, so that's it on fixing an election. Any questions about that? Yes. Oh, two. Yes. So the question is, she doesn't understand why, as the voter, when you're through voting, you can't just press printer and get your ballot printed out and put the ballot in the slot and see that it's correct, because the machines aren't set up that way, with a few exceptions. There are a couple of machines now that do have that, and two of the major vendors are developing models that have that ability. I'm not sure if you get the ballot and put it in the box yourself or if it automatically gets put into the box. But the vast majority of machines that are out there don't have that capability, even though they have printers attached to them. The printers are only used at the end of the election to do a mass printing. And that's what we're trying to get changed. And in fact, one of the issues is that you have to sometimes go in and program these machines for the specifics of the election. And that's another vulnerability, because as soon as you can do that, you can introduce a bug that way. And there have been problems with even just physical, just faceplates on these machines I just heard about that on the list that were wrong. Just plain old mistakes. Yes? They're not supposed to be networked. However, Diebold, which ran the Georgia election, some people discovered an open FTP site, a place on the web where they had source code and object code placed for the election. And the idea was, I think, that they had this so that people could download fixes to their bug fixes, presumably, to their machines. Now, whether or not they had downloaded some other fixes, I don't know. But the point is that because this was accessible from the outside, which, when you think about it from a security perspective, is mind-blowing. I'm actually not a computer security expert myself. I'm a computer scientist, but I'm learning a lot about security. But there are people who know more about it than I do. And they're saying, this stuff, you know, we can think of lots of ways to subvert it. Lots of ways. In fact, a good friend of mine, Peter Neumann, some of you may know the name, was involved with examining some computerized voting machines for New York City some years ago, which he had to do under a non-disclosure agreement, so he can't publish the stuff, but he said he found 37 different ways just off the top he could have subverted it. So the question, as I understand it, and please correct me if I misquote you, in Ontario County, people are saying that they have to store these machines and test them monthly, and that the cost is $700,000. They're projecting the cost to be $700,000. And you're asking if this is typical or if this is a standard thing? Yeah. Well, I didn't know that they would be testing them monthly. That's very interesting. Of course, if they're unchanged, they shouldn't have to be tested monthly. One of the arguments that we make is that these machines are being sold as being ultimately cheaper, because you buy them once and then, you know, you just run them to run the elections. And in fact, there are issues like this and issues like training people how to operate them and problems with startup and so on that actually increase the cost quite considerably. And what you're talking about is yet another. The storage is a major issue, because clearly you have to store these things under lock and key, and you have to make sure no one gets access to them. And you know, that definitely adds to the cost. I didn't know about the monthly testing. I'd love to talk to you about that afterwards. I'd like to get more information. So the question, and this, I'm very glad you asked that, because this is something which people often say. I mean, lots of people say this, which is computers are such an important factor in our lives. We use them in the banks. We use them for our car maintenance and so on. So it seems logical that we would use them for voting. And so I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, even when you use them, computers and banks make mistakes. Computers that check your car make mistakes. If they make a mistake on your car, you may end up having to pay more. Hopefully, you don't get into an accident. Usually, the mistakes aren't a big deal. With the banks, you have paper backup, right? I mean, you wouldn't want to make a deposit in the bank and they say, trust us. Would you? I mean, you want a receipt, right? I mean, I do. But with voting, you don't have that receipt. And you can't have that receipt because it's anonymous, it's secret. And the fact that voting is secret makes it a much harder problem and makes it different from all these other things involving computers. Another thing I'll hear is, well, we fly in airplanes which have computer control and we trust them, and yes, we do. Planes occasionally crash, sometimes maybe from computer problems, but by and large, they work okay. But you don't have people working in the airplane companies normally who have an incentive to make planes crash. I hope, because I'm flying home. But you can imagine that there can be a big incentive, financial or otherwise, to do something to an election. And there's a league discussion list which said plane crashes are much worse than stealing elections because people die. I'm not sure I believe that. I mean, it's horrible when people die, but stealing elections are very serious, and it has major implications. It can. So I think that's a terrible. So the statement is, elections have been stolen for a long time, with or without computers. So basically, why is this such a major issue? Is that, am I putting words into your mouth? I can't think of any other way. We want to have voter authenticated ballots. Now we don't necessarily, I'm saying paper, because I can't think of any other way to do it. Yeah. No. You can still have voter fraud. You can still have voter fraud. Oh, okay. So here's a definition of voter verification. Any protocol requiring a DRE to write votes onto a once, this is tech talk, write once external medium. In other words, you can't rewrite it. With a paper ballot, you can't rewrite it. You know, you want something which can't. See, one of the problems is people are saying we're storing it in the computer, we're storing the information in the computer, but that can be rewritten. Okay, so this is a definition. It cannot be, write once external, cannot be modified by software, allows the voter to independently verify, and that what is written is an accurate record of his or her choices. So that's what we mean by voter verification. So that doesn't say paper, but I don't know any other way to do it. And so, you know, I know, this problem has only been around for several years. People have been thinking about it for several years. No one has come up with another way. There may be another way. Doesn't require paper. If so, that'd be fine with me. But this is what I want. Another way, if this is just another rewording, a voter must be able to verify a permanent record of his or her vote. It's deposited in a secure ballot box. And we don't want the voter to keep it because we don't want vote selling. And by the way, I think it's also illegal, but in addition, it's not a good idea. And the ballot handling and counting must be observable. So once you get these paper ballots deposited, you still have vote fraud problems. You still have to worry about the same things that have happened with paper ballots in the past, having been stolen or something like that. But that's a known problem, and we can't get rid of that problem. And so what you need is good voting system, I mean, good election systems to make sure that you don't have fraud. Yes? So it's true that sight-impaired people cannot verify their paper ballots, presumably. Now, I think that there could be technologies developed which would allow them to do it, that would print them out so that you could scan it. But let's assume for the moment that they cannot. My guess is that most people will not verify their ballots, or at least a large number of people will not, including sighted people. The main reason I want this is that if enough people do verify their ballots, that's a check. And hopefully, if people start saying to election officials, look, this thing is not printing out what I said on the screen, people will realize there's a problem. Right, so the question is that legally this is a problem with ADA regulation. And the answer to that is if this is a problem, then so are touchscreen machines, because they can't read what's on touchscreen machines either.
If you need to have a paper ballot, why do you even need the computer? Why can't you do what they do in Canada, where you just vote in a paper ballot and put it in a box? Why have these machines?
So that's a good question. Optical scan machines also are a way of doing it. You do have a computer that counts it, but you have the paper ballots as backup. They're a lot cheaper. They're fine with me. I mean, I'm not pushing DREs. I'm just saying if you're going to buy them, make sure you don't buy insecure ones. That's really what I'm saying. Because people think these machines are great. So basically, those are, if you recall back at the very beginning, I think I had those arguments listed on the slide, advantages of DRE machines. And they can also have good human factors. They can be easy to use. The blind people are one of the major groups pushing this stuff. Someone asked me earlier who are the groups. The disability community are really pushing it because you can have earphones hooked onto these DRE machines, which tell you what's on the screen. You have to trust them, of course, but that can be tested. And they can vote that way. So it means you don't need to have someone with you. So I can understand that. And all I'm saying is that it's too bad they can't read a voter verified paper ballot right now, but the fact that other people can and do gives them more protection too. So had someone else had a question? Yes. I used to live on Long Island and I voted on lever machines. They can be fixed too. And you have the same problem of verifiability. You don't know once you've voted if your vote is correctly recorded. But even with lever machines, if you're going to fix them, you have to do it on a machine by machine basis. You can't do all the machines. Well, I mean, maybe you could. It would be difficult to do all the machines at one fell swoop the way you can with software. I think lever machines, I mean, I've used them, and I trusted it at the time, but now, given what I know, I wouldn't trust it as much. Even though I'm sure that in New York, they're never fixed. I was at Caltech a couple weeks ago. To do a computer security review of something called SERV, which is the Secure Electronic Registration and Voting Experiment. That's a $22 million DoD project, which is going to take place in 2004. There are 10 states that have signed up for it. Washington State, I know, is one of them. I don't know if New York is or not. I should have checked. A subset of the counties in those states. And the people who will be participating in this are overseas military and U.S. civilian citizens overseas from those states and counties. The system requirements, Windows 2000 or above. On the website it says Windows 95 or 98, but they told us at this meeting that some of the other requirements would rule those out. Microsoft Explorer 5.5 and above, or Netscape Navigator 6.0 and above, and ActiveX. The user is responsible for maintaining the security of his or her computer. Now, I find this mind-boggling, too. I mean, for a lot of people, just turning the damn thing on and getting it to work is, you know, they feel really good. Right? I mean, and you're going to worry about finding all these bugs and downloading the right software? Voting will be allowed from public computers with internet access, cyber cafes. Think about, pardon? Well, anyway. In other words, we will be doing voting, and this is also, as I say, primaries in 04 as well from these states. Voting for a national election will be conducted using proprietary software, insecure clients, and an insecure network. And there are some people involved with this project who are trying hard, but they can't get over that. I mean, if you're going to have voting on Windows 2000 over the internet, you've got problems. So here are some risks. Again, this is sort of a techie slide. Denial of service attacks on service. What that means is that basically you can't get your vote in. You've probably heard of denial of service attacks on the nets where you can't get to a particular website because there's too much stuff going there. It basically can't handle everything. Penetration attacks on servers. That's basically getting in and changing stuff. Spoofing attacks. You can put up a website that looks like the official website and it ain't. Another attack we thought of, which is sort of interesting. So when we raised this issue, when they said the user is going to be responsible for the security of his or her computer, we said, huh? And they said, well, but we'll help them. We'll provide them with free antivirus software. So here's another attack. You can, for example, monitor people who go to a particular candidate's website. And then you write them emails saying, we are the government. We're running this program. We know that these elections are insecure. We want you to have good software. Go to this website and download it. It'll protect your machine. Virus Trojan horse attacks on clients. As I say, that's where you install software into the client. You can do a lot of these things via the internet. I mean, you can get software into people's machines. Well, it happens all the time, right? People's machines. You've heard about people getting infected, you know, from stuff on the internet. Sysadmin attacks against voters on networks. That's just people who are operating this thing doing the attacks. Automatic vote selling, trading schemes. I mean, internet voting certainly allows for that. Insider attacks. Pop-up engineering ads during voting, which is not a security issue, but you can imagine how annoying that will be. Bugs in server software, bugs in client software. Several of us are really terrified that this will go smoothly. Or at least it will be perceived to have gone smoothly. Because, of course, we have no way of knowing whether or not it really went smoothly. At least the thing will work, in some sense. And then everybody's going to want it. In fact, there's one of the people who was on the panel. In fact, I think his dad works at Corning. He's this great guy. He's a computer security expert. And he afterwards, near the end of this thing, he got up there and he made a plea. He said, you know, if I thought you were going to do this in 06, I would get down on my hands and knees and beg you not to do it. Because he beg you not to do it. Because he's broken into a lot of systems himself. So he knows how easy it is. So there's a bill that's been introduced by Rush Holt called the vote, HR 2239 is what it's called. All voting systems must produce voter-verified paper ballots for use in manual audit and recount. And the paper ballots are the official record for any recount. Actually, I think they should be the official record, period. I think that the computer results should be the initial, the initial results because the networks all want it. Bans use of undisclosed software. The election vendors won't like that. And software is made available by a commission for inspection by any citizen requesting it. The commission here is the commission that the HAVA law creates. It would ban wireless communication devices. Must be implemented by the 2004 election. Requires voting systems for persons with disabilities a year earlier than HAVA does. And it has mandatory surprise recounts in 0.5% of domestic and overseas jurisdictions. So that's the bill that Rush Holt is pushing. I think he has 20 endorsers at the moment. It's going to be a hard bill to get passed. And so I have a whole bunch of slides on HAVA. Most of them are boring. I'm not going to go over them. I'll just tell you a little bit about it. So the funding to replace punch cards and lever voting machines by the 04 election, voluntary system guidelines. I mean, there are no rules about what these things have to look like, and there's a lot of money available, so people are rapidly buying the machines. They're afraid the money will go away. NIST was supposed to, as I say, provide guidelines, and they have not been given the funding. So they're authorized in the legislation to do a whole bunch of things. This is some of them, but they weren't funded. And then finally, these are just some quotes from the legislation itself. The audit requirements, the voting system shall produce a permanent paper record with a manual audit capacity for such systems. The voting system shall provide the voter with an opportunity to challenge the ballot or correct any error, and the paper record shall be available as an official record for any recount. Now, to me, what they're doing doesn't satisfy this. When you print out the paper ballots at the end of the election, I don't think it should satisfy this law. You were asking about a lawsuit. Because printing out the paper ballots at the end of the election doesn't tell you anything. It just tells you what's in the machine, or if the printer works or not. You know, that's all it tells you. So, you know, when you have these auditing requirements, it must surely have, the intent must have been to print out the ballot when the voter votes, so the voter can verify it. What can you do? Well, there are a couple things you can do. One thing you can do is sign David Dill's petition, and there's the website, verifiedvoting.org, verified.org. And he's collecting signatures from everybody. I mean, he started off with computer scientists, but he's greatly expanded it. Also, he's looking for organizations to sign up. That's also a wealth of information at that website. And we're trying to make this into a central repository of information, which is why one of the reasons why I'm eager to talk to people who've told me about local things here, because I'd like to get that to David. I mentioned USACM. The organization that was mentioned that I was president of is called Association for Computing Machinery. I also founded and co-chair the U.S. Public Policy Committee of ACM, which we call USACM. We've been involved with this issue too, and we have a voting website, but it's you know, we have a few things up there that we've done, but basically David Dill's website is the main website on this. When I really got seriously involved with this was when San Mateo County was about to buy machines. San Mateo County, Silicon Valley. It's where I live. And just after David Dill started his project, David Dill is on sabbatical this year. He thought he'd take a month or two off and fix this. And it's just consumed his life. So shortly after he started, he discovered that these machines were about to be purchased. I mean, this had been going on for a while, but we didn't know about it. And so I ended up going to meeting with the Board of Supervisors. First, David and I went and met with an individual one, and then we went to Board of Supervisors meetings, which are incredibly tedious. And it was rather frustrating. Basically, what happened in San Mateo County was that there were three companies that were certified by the state of California when they started on this project. And so they took bids from all three. There were no others, and they were all paperless, all paperless. And the staff were very, very diligent. And they had focus groups. They were very concerned about usability. They were very concerned about disability, use for people with disabilities. San Mateo County has Stanford University, it has Santa Clara University, San Jose State. There are several major computer science departments in San Mateo County. There are major companies. They didn't talk to any single computer scientist, not one that I know of. They certainly, if they'd gone to Stanford and raised this issue, people would have laughed. By the time we got involved, it was so far along, we couldn't stop it. The only thing we were able to do was to get the company that got the contract to agree that if, and it's not clear if it's just required or optional, I think they'll probably interpret it as saying required, if paper ballots are required, they will retrofit their machines at no additional cost to the county. If they're optional, I don't know what happens. We actually got the board to vote 3-2, so we almost won. As a result of this and all the local publicity, the San Jose Mercury News was fantastic. They had wonderful editorials. And as a result, Shelley, I think his name is, the Secretary of State, California, convened a commission to look at this issue. David Dill was on the commission. There were David Dill, David Jefferson, who are both computer scientists, Kim Alexander, who's not but has been working this issue for a long time, were on it, and then six other people, including a registrar from a county which has already purchased these machines. So there were nine people on the commission, and they split 6-3. And they recommended paper ballots, they recommended voter-authenticated ballots, but they didn't require them immediately, you know, sometime in the distant future. So, you know, we started getting some national press as a result of this, and we've raised the issue. And that's one of the reasons that I think we're getting a lot of pushback, a lot of pushback. Well, you're talking, I think, about the Diebold software that was on the OpenFTP website that some people have started reverse engineering. I think that's what you're talking about, with the different copies. And what they're trying to claim is that they had two sets of books. That's what they were claiming. I don't know if that's true or not. There's an interesting situation in this country, which I probably don't have time to get into right now, but there's something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which makes it illegal to reverse engineer software that's been copyrighted so long as there's any kind of copyright protection applied to it, like a password, for example. So there's an interesting situation where there are people who have their hands on this software. They are reverse engineering it, and they are at risk of being found guilty of a federal felony, even if they find fraud in the election software. But getting back to your question about the software, that's why. But if we have the paper ballots, that's not an issue, because in the paper ballots are the definitive vote, not the software, not what the computer says. So as long as the paper ballots represent the actual vote, you don't care how badly the computer screws up. The question is, does anyone double-check the totals? Well, I assume that that's what we have Democratic and Republican poll watchers for. I mean, if you look at the, if you've counted the paper ballots at each county, and that's publicized, if the results from each county are publicized, we should be able to add them up correctly.
It seems perfectly clear from everything that has been said that the principle involved is that the more steps you put into anything, the more opportunities you create for intervention, and the more opportunities you create for intervention, the more interventions there will be. And many of us have back our licenses recently, and of course we now registered as this or the other thing. And of course, that also provides an opportunity for intervention. If we had even 2% of driver's licenses fake, that could be enough to throw a great proportion of elections.
As to the question of what happens if they put these machines in place despite everything we do, isn't insisting on taking an absentee ballot instead of going to the machines an option? And isn't a threat of massive voter rejection of the machines? I mean, these people want to spend millions of dollars for machines that we say we're not going to use. Which leads me to another question. I'm concerned about spending millions and millions of dollars for machines that spend most of their time in climate-controlled storage. What I argued in Pennsylvania was that we should have open source DREs that run on off-the-shelf equipment that could be used for something else when it's not being used to vote. So that's something that people might want to keep in mind as well.
As long as we've got voter authenticated paper ballots, right?
Yeah.
A couple of other things. Someone in the front row earlier was talking about costs besides purchasing the machines. Gray and I met with our county, that's Allegheny County Election Commissioners last week, and learned that the $7,000 apiece that is being budgeted for the cost of these machines, which is a ripoff, it is outrageous, only 4,000 of those 7,000 will be reimbursed. That's just the purchase. We haven't talked about storage and training workers and all that. It is going to be so expensive that I just read this week on electionline.org that Laramie County, Colorado, has decided to reduce their 143 precincts in their one county down to 26 voting centers, and now people are going to go a longer distance to an impersonal place to vote on the new machine. There's so much we don't know and we're not being told because somebody doesn't want to tell us. Folks, if you did not pick up a pink handout, there are 10 things you can do. This includes the federal legislation, the state legislation, and a lot of other things in between. But the number one item, New Yorkers, please, between now and Wednesday, is to write it can be a few sentences only, but you need to fax your comments about the New York State plan and what you like or don't like or what you think should be done. It has to be received by Wednesday the 23rd. But interestingly, when you look through the 48 pages of that plan, there's not one sentence that says New York State is planning to buy electronic machines, but there is one line on the budget, which is page 26, which lists $140 million. That's 20,000 machines times 7,000 apiece, that's $140 million. That's what our state is planning to do unless we can stop them.
That was Dr. Barbara Simons with comments from members of the audience that included local legislators, speaking on July 19th in Montour Falls, New York. The deadline for public comment on New York State's voting plan is Wednesday, July 23rd. Comments can be faxed to the New York State Board of Elections at area code 518-473-8315, and this is the fax number of the New York State Board of Elections, area code 518-473-8315. For more information on touchscreen voting machines,